Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In his new book, American Hate, Survivors Speak Out, today's guest, civil rights attorney Arjun Sethi Singh, writes, quote, "This country was built on a hate crime. The native people of this land were displaced and exterminated to make room for Christians and Europeans. Hate has been a fixture of this country for as long as it has existed. But since the election of Donald Trump, something has changed." Arjun Sethi Singh met with a diverse range of people living in the United States whose lives have been forever changed by hate. He also met with organizers, activists, and policy advocates, and they all said something similar. The election of Trump emboldened racism, xenophobia, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, sexism, transphobia, ableism, and anti-immigrant hostility. As Arjun Sethi Singh traveled the country, he says he has come to realize that in many ways, the purpose of hate is to silence. But these survivors refuse to be silenced. In American Hate, survivors tell their own stories in their own words. Asma Al-Bukai is a Syrian refugee living in Boise, Idaho. She fears banishment and hate violence. After Taylor Dempsey became the first Black student body president at American University, she found nooses hanging across campus on her first day in office. Haifa, Victoria, and Rami Jabara lost their loved one, Khalid Jabara, to a violent hate crime in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He was shot and killed by a neighbor. Tanya Gersh, a Jewish woman, was stalked, trolled, and intimidated by white nationalists and neo-Nazis who threatened to march on her home in Whitefish, Montana. These are just a few of the stories that we read about in Arjun Sethi Singh's new book. And joining us to talk about these stories and more is Arjun Singh Sethi, a community activist, civil rights lawyer, writer, and professor based in Washington, D.C. He works closely with Muslim, Arab, South Asian, and Sikh communities and advocates for racial justice, equity, and social change at the local and national levels. And Arjun joins us from D.C. Hi, Arjun. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for writing this book. I just want to say at the outset that some people might be triggered by some of the things we talk about today. Some of the details we might talk about could be very disturbing to people. I have to say, after each story, I had to sit with it and take a couple deep breaths because they were all so very intense. And before we dive in and talk about your book, and I also want to get your thoughts on the House Judiciary Committee's hearing on white nationalism today, I just wonder, Arjun, talk a little bit about how you got involved in this work. I know that this is very personal for you because you're very sensitive to the rising tide of hate violence because of your Sikh American identity. You write that when you researched this book, you were nearly driven off the road in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You were stared down by a cashier and a customer in a grocery store in Kalispell, Montana, and you were misdirected on the campus of American University in Washington. So talk a little bit about, you know, how you got involved in this work and, you know, just... Sorry, are you hearing that?
I am, yes. You know, I come at this work from lots of different angles, and really it stems from some of what I experienced as a young child. In elementary school, I was viciously bullied on account of being brown, on account of being a Sikh American who had long hair. And that was an experience that really stood with me and really motivated me to speak up for others, to support others who were being persecuted in any form or shape, whether it was bullying, whether it was hate speech, whether it was hate violence. And really, that was a theme. Working with the marginalized, working on civil rights has been a commitment of mine throughout high school, college, and even in law school. I focused on civil and human rights. And then at some point, I experienced a sort of intellectual turn where I felt like a lot of lawmakers, a lot of legislators, a lot of media pundits weren't actually acting in service of impacted communities, that they really didn't have the needs of survivors sort of at the kind of forefront of their minds. And so really the impetus behind American Hate, Survivors Speak Out was simply that. As a community activist, I was working closely with Muslims, Arabs, South Asians, Sikhs across the United States who were experiencing an uptick in hate and hate violence, and they felt like they didn't have a seat at the table. They felt like the American public and the American media would cover their story for a matter of hours, maybe a day if they were lucky, and they would move on. And so I thought it was important to give them a platform. And as you also pointed out, you know, some of the sort of bigotry that I experienced when I was young continues today. And that is absolutely right. When I was doing research on this book, I myself experienced numerous incidents of hate. After meeting with the family of Khalid Jabara, a young Arab American who was murdered in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I was driving back to the airport when someone nearly drove me off the road. When I was in Whitefish, Montana, meeting with Tanya Gersh, a Jewish American who was viciously cyber-trolled on account of being Jewish, I was afraid to actually eat out at night, and so I would often go to the grocery store, pick up a frozen meal that I would then warm up in my microwave in my hotel. And the last night I was there, a cashier and a customer stared me down to the point where I felt scared, and I actually had to move to another line to make my purchase and, you know, quickly exit the store.
Wow. And as you write, Arjun, Donald Trump's actions have real consequences and will be more than a footnote in world history. You met with so many people on your travels, and they all said that the election of Trump has made all of this worse. It's emboldened racism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism. Can you elaborate more on that?
Absolutely. You know, earlier you mentioned the House Judiciary Committee, and today Candace Owens actually testified shamefully in front of Congress and basically denied that there was a material or a noticeable spike in hate. And that's really a talking point that's been echoed by a lot of people in the GOP or sort of those aligned with them. They believe that hate hasn't spiked during the Trump administration and that somehow it's a figment of our imagination. But if you speak to impacted communities, and by impacted communities, I mean people who are perceived as different. And that includes Muslims, Jewish folks, refugees, immigrants, the Latinx community, folks from the LGBTQ community. I met with people from all of those communities. And as you pointed out, Rose, every single person that I met with believes that hate has spiked in the last 3 years because of the rhetoric and policies of the Trump administration. And furthermore, the data shows that. So according to the FBI, hate spiked in 2016, spiked again in 2017. And again, if you speak to community organizations that track this information every day, community organizations who work on the front lines with survivors, they will also tell you that their reporting, that their statistics also show a material spike in hate in this political moment.
And I don't want to spend too much time talking about this hearing on white nationalism and hate crimes, because I really want to dive in and talk about the people that you interviewed. But the House Judiciary Committee is holding a hearing on hate crimes today, and an organization called South Asian Americans Leading Together put out a statement this morning saying that this does not include survivors who experienced hate violence since the 2016 election, with the exception of Dr. Abu Salha, a courageous man, as you wrote on Twitter, whose two daughters and son-in-law were murdered in Chapel Hill, North Carolina in 2015. But this group says that we demand Congress hold substantive hearings that center survivors and that unequivocally reject white nationalism. So for listeners who have not been following this hearing, you've been tweeting about it all morning, Arjun. Just talk about what's happening there.
Thank you for bringing that up. So as you pointed out, Rose, South Asian Americans Leading Together, along with the Muslim Justice Collective, an organization in D.C., rallied 20 local and national organizations to sign a letter expressing their absolute outrage and dismay at the congressional hearing taking place today, which is supposed to be on hate crimes and white nationalism. And what's actually happened is that the Judiciary Committee has actually given space to folks like Candace Owens, who've espoused hateful views, who espoused hateful views today. And furthermore, and most importantly, the panel does not include a single survivor of hate violence post-Trump. So Dr. Mm-hmm. Abu Salah is a courageous man. As you pointed out, his two daughters and son-in-law were murdered in a vicious hate crime in Chapel Hill in North Carolina. But he is the only survivor that is being that's testifying today. He should be alongside mm-hmm. other survivors from the Muslim community, the Jewish community, the Sikh community, the undocumented community, from the LGBT community, who can talk about their experiences. And instead, Dr. Abu Salah is being forced today in the halls of Congress to answer the question, is Islam a hateful faith? Did you teach your daughters that Islam is a peaceful faith, right? And so what he is being subjected to in Congress today is a national disgrace. And I would encourage our the listeners today to follow along online. The hashtag is End Hate. The hashtag is Stop White Supremacy. And as there should be, there is real popular outrage at today's hearing because of the equivocation about white supremacy and because, as these groups pointed out, including SALT and the Justice for Muslim Collective or Muslim Justice Collective, that survivors are not being given space. And when they are being given space, like Dr. Abu Salah, they're being forced to endure this vicious and ugly interrogation about their genuinely held religious beliefs.
Right. I mean, it was painful to have to watch Dr. Abu Salah defend Islam and have to answer these horrible questions about whether his mosque teaches hate. I mean, this is a man who lost his two daughters and son-in-law. And I hope that you can take time out of your day today to read about what happened to Dr. Abu Salah's family. The way he spells it, it's A-B-U-S-A-L-H-A. So Arjun, I wanted to ask you what I was saying before we had to go to break. What I really appreciate about the stories you tell is because there's so much happening, there's so much news happening, you hear about these stories, but you don't really get the backstory. And that is what was, I think, so powerful about the stories, the people that you spoke with and the people who told their own stories. And I would like to just talk about Haifa, Victoria, and Rami Jabara. They are Christian Lebanese Americans. Their family home is in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I'm sure that a lot of people heard about what happened to Khalid. He was shot and killed by his neighbor. But the detail that his sister, brother, and mother share in your book really didn't get out. So can you talk a little bit about their story?
Absolutely. The story of Khalid Jabara is an American tragedy. And so as you pointed out, Rose, the Jabaras are a Christian Arab family that fled the civil war in Lebanon and made a home for themselves in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And all was well until the white supremacists moved next door, who terrorized the family, called them things like dirty Arabs, ISIS, told them to go home. The family got a restraining order against the next door neighbor. Fast forward several months, the next door neighbor runs over Haifa Jabara. This is the mother of the family. She's hospitalized for weeks, barely survives. Initially, the next door neighbor was not allowed to post bond because of his history of menacing the family. But a new prosecutor was appointed to the case who didn't know the case history. And so when defense counsel made a renewed motion for bond, the prosecutor didn't object, and the judge granted it. And so one day, the Jabaras learn that the white supremacist next door has been released pending trial, and he's returning home without any conditions, right? He's allowed to carry a gun, no ankle monitor, no nothing. He's allowed to return home next door to the family he terrorized. Fast forward several months, Khalid Jabara is in his home. He hears shooting and hears the next-door neighbor yell, call the police, call the police, he has a gun. Khalid does what he's supposed to do. He calls the police. The police show up, and they knock on the next-door neighbor's door. He doesn't answer. The police come back to Khalid's doorstep and say to him, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do. He's not answering, and we don't have probable cause to kick the door down. Khalid reminds them of who the next-door neighbor is, how he terrorized the family, how they had a restraining order against him, how he ran over his mother just months earlier. The police leave, and minutes later, the next-door neighbor emerges from his house and murders Khalid Jabara on his front doorstep.
You know, it's such a horrific story, and even the minor details of Khalid's sister and brother and mom saying things like the neighbor called them dirty Arabs, Arabs, and Muslims, and just the daily vitriol that they had to endure. I mean, this is a theme in many of the stories in your book, just what people had to deal with. I mean, in this case, it was a neighbor, and they couldn't move because their father has a disability, and the house was set up specifically for his disability.
You know, that's right. And I will tell you, when I had initially set out on this project, I had actually thought to only include the most searing examples of hate violence, namely assault and murder. But I quickly realized I'd be doing a disservice to impacted communities because hate manifests in so many ways. And so with the Jabaras, as you rightly point out, they experienced every type of hate. They experienced ugly hate speech. They experienced hateful vitriol. They experienced assault in the case of Haifa Jabara, and they experienced murder in the case of Khalid Jabara. But there are many people who experienced just hate speech, who experienced just vicious forms of cyber trolling, and those experiences matter too. And that's why American Hate Survivors Speak Out really tries to capture the breadth of ways in which people experience hate throughout this country, which is why I have a story of bullying. I have a few stories of vicious cyber trolling. I have stories of vandalism and arson of houses of worship, and unfortunately and regrettably in some cases, assault and murder.
Mm. Are you still in touch with some of the subjects? I mean, especially this family who lost a loved one to gun violence. Victoria, Khalid's sister, says, "I'm doing a lot of education and interfaith work in my local community. I decided after Khalid's death that if we want love and understanding, we must start with our children." So on July 7th, 2017, on what would have been Khalid's 38th birthday, a library at my daughter's preschool in Tulsa was dedicated in his name. The Khalid Jabara Tikkun Olam Library contains children's books and family resources. I mean, so many of the people that you spoke with, Arjun, obviously this has changed their lives. And it's almost like they have even more pressure to try to speak out to their community and bring people together. I mean, that's a lot to ask of someone.
It is. And, you know, I will tell you that one of the things that I found most striking when I traveled the country is how resilient and how optimistic and how hopeful survivors are. It's true. The book is painful at times. But I think anybody who reads it will also find that every single survivor, every single testimonial includes very concrete examples of how survivors are rebuilding, how they're doubling down, you know, on their communities and trying to heal and move forward. And I think it's extraordinary, and the Jabaras are a real example of that. And, you know, when you ask if I'm in touch with the survivors, I am, absolutely. One of the things that I've actually tried to do in connection with the book is to actually hold community events across the country that feature the survivors. And so for folks who are actually interested, there's a book Instagram account called Survivors Speak Out, where you can actually see photos of a lot of these community events. So you can see photos of me, Victoria, Rami, and Haifa Jabara. You can see photos of me with Destiny Mangum and Walia Muhammad, the two young women who were aboard the MAX train in Portland, with Jeanette Vizguerra, an undocumented immigrant who actually was just 2 weeks ago forced again to take sanctuary at a house of worship because she is again fearing being pulled apart from her family. And so I've done community events, and when I was actually in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the last event that I did in 2018 was a reading at the Tikkun Olam Khalid Jabara Memorial Library in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I read actually a children's story to a lot of pre-K youth about diversity and about acceptance and about sort of, you know, cherishing our differences and sort of our collective uniqueness.
Mm. Today we're speaking with Arjun Singh Sethi about his book, American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. Arjun is a community activist, civil rights lawyer, writer, and professor based in Washington, D.C., and he works closely with Muslim, Arab, South Asian, and Sikh communities, advocating for racial justice, equity, and social change. And if you have any questions or comments for Arjun, We'd love to hear from you. If you or your community has been targeted by xenophobia, racism, anti-immigrant sentiment, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, how have you been impacted by this? How has your community responded? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And what are your thoughts about just where we are right now? I mean, Arjun tweeted this morning about this white nationalism and hate crime hearing. This is the first hearing on these issues since Trump took office. And, you know, a lot of people are saying it's an affront to survivors because there's only one survivor on the panel. And Arjun tweeted, more than 250,000 people are targeted by hate crimes every year, and the number continues to grow because of the rhetoric and the policies of this administration. So what are your thoughts about where we are right now and how communities should respond, how communities are responding? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. In the book, American Hate, Survivors Tell Their Own Stories. Arjun, you just mentioned Destiny Mangum and Walia Muhammad. On May 26, 2017, Destiny Mangum, 16, and Walia Muhammad, 17, were aboard a Max Light rail train in Portland, Oregon, when a known white supremacist, Jeremy Joseph Christian, fatally stabbed two people, Ricky John Best and Talisin Mirdeen Namki Mesh, and injured a third, Mika David Cole Fletcher. This is the first time that Destiny and Walia have spoken together publicly about what happened that day. And I was really struck about what Walia said. It became a national story and it was too much for me. I didn't talk to anyone because I didn't like the attention. I hid because I didn't want the cameras on me. I had already been through so much and I just wanted my old life back. She said, I also liked Portland growing up, but I do not feel comfortable here anymore. Everywhere I go, I fear for my safety. So Walia is a Somali immigrant. She said that she decided to take off her hijab a few months ago because she just does not feel safe anymore. It's kind of amazing. I was thinking about these young women, and just to learn that it's the first time that they spoke publicly together with you, what really stood out for you in the conversation that you had with them?
What stood out to me is the amount of acute and extraordinary pain that those two young women were in when I met them. And I can tell you, again, I revisited with them after the book came out and we did an event in Oregon, and they are doing a little better now, and that's really nice to see. But I will tell you, when I met them in 2017, the feelings were really raw, and they felt neglected by the public. They felt ignored by their own community. They felt like their story had been trafficked by the media. You know, Walia and Destiny talk in the testimonial about a reporter who followed them around and never introduced herself, and then one day just happened to say, I'm a reporter, I'd like to meet with you. And, you know, when I met with them at the time, you know, they talked to me about how all they wanted was funding so that they could apply to colleges because they didn't even have the money for college application fees. And so I couldn't help but wonder what an injustice and disservice we've done to survivors of hate across this country. Here are these two young women, extraordinary, ages 16 to 17, viciously bullied on the MAX train in Portland, Oregon. They see two people stabbed to death who defend them, and they feel ignored, and they feel neglected. And that's really our collective responsibility. And so I will tell you that for my part, I feel very proud that these two young women decided to speak up and to tell their story. And I also feel proud that in connection with the book, they increasingly now have additional resources that they need to go on with their lives, whether that's applying to college, whether that's getting the mental and emotional health support that they need as well.
Destiny says that they were not even supposed to be on the train that day. They got lost. They were on the train in the afternoon when Christian, the white supremacist shooter, got on. And I think it's important to let people know just what people like Destiny and Walia had to endure. She said, for 8 minutes, he just yelled at us, you're nothing, kill yourself, get out of this country, burn, Muslims should die, go back to Saudi Arabia. And, you know, Arjun, I think it's important to talk about this, especially for people who've never had to deal with this, because for many, this is a regular occurrence.
It is, right? There, as you pointed out a little while ago, more than 250,000 people experience hate violence every year. Millions experience different forms of bullying, hate speech, and sort of cyber trolling. And really what we need to be doing is making sure that we understand the scope of the problem, making sure that survivors of all kinds have the resources they need, and making sure that we give them a platform to tell their stories. And again, one of the things that is so painful about today's hearing is that some of the survivors I met should be testifying in the People's Chamber today. They should be talking about their stories. They should be talking about the needs they have, the resources they need, and their communities need. And the other thing I wanted to emphasize, and this is something that came really throughout my work, is that, you know, people, when they think about hate crimes and they think about hate, they often think about laws, right, and think about hate crime laws. But, you know, these aren't just legal issues. These are public health issues. Racism and hate are impacting the health and livelihood of our communities. We know, for example, that black women are three times more likely to die during childbirth than white women. You can hold all variables constant, including education, class, resources, and health care the day of the childbirth. Literally, communities of color, women, and so many other folks in this country are dying prematurely, right? Because of hate, racism, misogyny, and the like. And so we need to treat these issues like public health issues.
And Taylor Dumpson, who became the first black student body president at American University, found nooses hanging across campus on her first day in office. And to your point, she said, quote, "I had been student government president for exactly 4 days. I took the next 10 days off from school to regroup. In the ensuing weeks, I cried often, had nightmares, and struggled with fear and anxiety. I don't remember much because I tried to block it from my mind. I was later diagnosed with PTSD and am presently being treated for it." I mean, and just another harrowing story. I mean, Taylor Dumpson goes to American University like so many young people and is so excited about what's to come. She writes about how she was changed by the murder of Trayvon Martin, about Michael Brown, and then she becomes the first black woman to run for student body president and actually wins. So tell us more about Taylor Dumpson.
You know, so as you point out, Taylor Dumpson is an extraordinary young black woman. She goes to American University with sort of hopeful aspirations and bright eyes, looking to change the world in Washington, D.C. Trump takes office, and Taylor decides to run for student body president at American University, and she wins. She becomes the first black woman in the history of American University to hold the position of student body president. This is American University. This is 3 miles from the White House. The day that Taylor takes office, April 1st, 2017, nooses are found hanging across campus. And then days later, the Daily Stormer and other white supremacist blogs and outfits start trolling her online and start saying racially derogatory things about her, Photoshop her hair with KFC buckets of chicken. And so she talks in her testimonial about how she experienced major emotional and mental health issues and how she was diagnosed with PTSD. And Taylor today actually remains a champion of those issues, and she works and encourages survivors of hate across this country to make sure that they get the support and resources they need. And you know, one of the things that I think is so striking about Taylor's story is that if you were to just see the headline, right, and see it and read it, and it says, you know, black woman elected student body president, nooses found hanging across campus, you might think that that's a headline from the 50s, the 60s. You might even think that that could be a headline in 2017, but that it's not, you know, in a major city, right? But this was in Washington, D.C., and that speaks to a bigger, broader point, right? Hate isn't a red state problem. It's not a blue state problem. It's not a black problem. It's not a brown problem. It's an American problem, right? Hate is striking and is impacting rich folks, poor folks, brown folks, black folks, men, women, people from the queer community, cities, rural communities, right? It is ubiquitous. And when we're talking about how to take it on and how to resist it. I think it's really important to not marginalize or isolate that. We have to remember that this is an American problem.
You know, the other thing that struck me about Taylor Dempsey is she actually brought up the First Amendment. And I think this is another important thing to talk about. She wrote, "I think free speech has its limits. It's one thing to have differences of opinion, but quite another to attack another person's humanity. I repeatedly felt threatened by people's words and messages during my time at American University, but we didn't begin to see real change until the physical threat with the nooses." So can you talk about this? Just her and other people also brought up the First Amendment. I mean, Taylor, basically, she said, we need to better understand how words alone, even those protected by the First Amendment, impact mental health.
So I think this is a really important issue, and there are a lot of people in this world who believe in sort of orthodox understandings of free speech, right? That any attempt to a ban or prohibit hate speech as some form of censorship. But here's the thing. If you speak to people who've actually been impacted by vicious forms of hate speech, including Taylor Dempsey, if you speak to survivors, they will tell you that they favor the government taking a stronger stand against hate speech because hate speech often leads to hate violence. And furthermore, as Taylor pointed out, as Tanya Gersh pointed out in another testimony in my book, hate speech alone can cause PTSD. And so when thinking about free speech and hate speech, we can't just be thinking about it as a legal issue. We need to be thinking about it as a public health issue. I will also tell you, in my opinion, that I think we should really be thinking about hate speech differently in the context of the 21st century than we did just a few years ago. And so, for example, there have been numerous instances of gun-toting white supremacists lining up outside mosques in the United States, yelling terrible things about Muslims, including, go home, you don't belong here, Islam is a violent faith. I will tell you that I don't think we should force Muslim youth to endure that. I think Muslim youth should be able to walk the streets and go to Friday prayer at the mosque without having to walk by gun-toting white supremacists. And any legal regime that allows for that or puts the burden on them, right, to somehow resist and protest gun-toting white supremacists outside a mosque isn't a reasonable regime, right? Mm. They shouldn't be asked to sort of carry that burden. And I will also tell you that I'm in favor of companies like Facebook, Google, and Twitter taking on white supremacists. I don't think white supremacists should be able to use those platforms. And let me just make it clear how easy it is to incite hate online. All you need is a deep pocket, right? Let's say you've got millions of dollars, a piece of fake news, an article, you contact Facebook and you say, you know what? I want you to use your targeting advertising metrics and indicators, and I want you to get this hateful piece of fake news in front of millions of people who already espouse these views, thus creating an echo chamber, thus reinforcing bigotry and hate, which is why Facebook actually facilitated and contributed to genocide in Myanmar. Right, this is now well documented, which is why people have concerns about what Twitter is being used for in India in the run-up to the elections. And so I really think when thinking about privacy and thinking about free speech, we can't be thinking about what happened in the 60s and 70s. We need to be thinking about free speech in the context of the digital era, in the context of cyber trolling and cyber bullying, in the context of the proliferation of guns and gun violence, and be thinking about it in the context of fake news and targeted advertising through the lens and eyes of companies like Facebook and Twitter.
Hmm. Well, let's take a call. Let's hear from Ben in Cupertino. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to mention that I'm an older, more mature person, but when I was a kid, my mother told me that there was a sign that was put out by the public library. This is in Albuquerque. This is by the city. The sign stated, "No dogs or Indians," and that was Native Americans, "no dogs or Indians allowed on the grass." And I'm still traumatized from that, even though it was not direct experience for me, but just hearing that just really, it just boggled my mind even as a child. But I did a lot of traveling after that, hitchhiked cross-country a few times, and oh my God, the the racism I encountered, not against me, but what I overheard against blacks and Hispanics, oh, it was just so horrible. One encounter with, in a car was with two white, young white men, just bantering around saying, I don't think, I'm not racist. I think we should have the right to own a black person just like everybody else, that kind of thing. But the racism was so intense. But I think the remedy for all of this is that we have a white patriarchal society. I think we need to have more women decision makers. I'd like to see half the Congress and half the Senate consisting of women, and in all city and state political systems, women. It's too patriarchal. It's too much punishment. It's too much hatred. It's too much racism. Let's get some balance in there, and maybe we can have a kind of system that Sweden has. It's a more gentler system.
Thank you for calling in, Ben. You have to be specific about the kind of women that you want in office. I mean, just quickly, Arjun, it's important to point out that Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen just left her position, reportedly under pressure from Trump and his hardline immigration advisor, Stephen Miller. And we're expecting that they're going to mount an even more brutal response to the arrival of migrants and asylum seekers at the border.
Absolutely, right? And one of the themes of my book is that state violence intensifies hate violence. When Donald Trump is going to cage and separate immigrant families, ban Muslims, ban asylum seekers, call Syrian snakes, call African countries, you know, ex-countries, right? Ex-whole countries, right? It's going to embolden hate against our communities, and that's what we've seen. Even in my book, for example, I talk about how in December 2015, Donald Trump on the campaign trail said he wanted to ban Muslims from entering the United States. That same day, someone left a pig's head outside the Al-Aqsa Islamic Society Mosque in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Fast forward. January 2017, Donald Trump signs the executive order banning Muslims and refugees. That night, a mosque in Victoria, Texas is burned to the ground. This president, his advisors, his policies have emboldened and incited hate against vulnerable communities across this country.
Well, we have about a minute left, Arjun, and I wish we had, we have to have you back to talk more about these stories, but just quickly, Tanya Gersh, a Jewish woman, was stalked, trolled, and intimidated by white nationalists and neo-Nazis who threatened to march on her home in Whitefish, Montana. And like so many of the other people who told stories in your book, she says, quote, I see a psychiatrist regularly. I was recently diagnosed with a classic case of PTSD. I struggle with anxiety. I get scared. Often, if somebody is walking really fast in my direction, I get anxious. If a car makes a quick U-turn, my heart races. But here's the one, if we can end on somewhat of a positive note on this show. Tanya says, what gives me hope, and this is a woman who was not an activist at all before this happened. She says, what gives me hope is the activists who fight every day to make this world a better place. People from all walks of life standing up for Jews, Muslims, communities of color, and other vulnerable groups. I believe that most of the world is on the right side and wants change. It seemed like that was a theme. You know, some people said that this, when you talk about intersectionality, this is what they're talking about. But people like Tanya, who was never an activist before, and now she's talking about the importance of expressing solidarity with other communities.
Absolutely. And that was really empowering even for me. I found that survivors across the country weren't just interested in helping their communities. They were looking to figure out how they could help other communities, how Jewish communities could help Muslim communities, how Muslim communities could help Jewish communities, how Japanese Americans stood up with Muslims in the wake of the travel ban, how Native communities have worked closely with undocumented communities and Latinx communities because they know that the wall and the borders are arbitrary and colonial. And so really, if one looks closely and one looks deeply, there is really good reason to be optimistic and hopeful. But it requires hard work. And I encourage all of the listeners today to figure out a way to get involved. Use your resources, use your privilege, use your knowledge to make a difference and support impacted communities in this difficult moment.
Arjun Singh Sethi is the author of American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. Arjun is a community activist, civil rights lawyer, writer, and professor based in Washington. Arjun, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for joining us. And I'm really sorry about the technical issues. We would love to have you back.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. We'll do it again soon.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And if you are in the Bay Area, your call will be live this Friday at Mission High School's Little Theater at 5 p.m. We will be speaking with Oakland writer Chizu Omori, who was incarcerated in a World War II camp at age 12. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.